Hello, I'm Alex Stevenson, and I present a podcast about the Napoleonic period. It's called The Napoleonic Quarterly. You're probably familiar with it because you're listening to this. And if you're not, I urge you to start from the very beginning. But why would you be listening to this as the entry episode? Maybe I'll put Austerlitz in the title and that might be why. Okay, if this is your first experience of the Napoleonic Quarterly, you need to go back to the start of this film, or you need to go back to the start of the episode feed and, you know, spend the time working up to Austerlitz. It'll take you a while, but I'm sure it'll be worth it. Whatever you do, don't just type in Austerlitz and look up some other episode. However, if you were one of... I mean, there's not many reasons to listen to this. As listeners, maybe one of the very limited reasons would be to enjoy my diminishing morale as we progress through these 10 episodes, each one of which looks at 15 minutes of Sir Ridley Scott's 2023 disappointment, Napoleon, in air quotes. It's an epic, spectacle-filled movie blockbuster, which is historically problematic. And having listened to so many people in the Napoleonic community lament this missed opportunity, I just thought we could get a screenwriter along to help maybe at least explore and understand some of the decisions that have been made. That screenwriter is, of course, James Topham. Hello, James.
Hello, Alex. Lovely to be here. I thought for a moment there you might get to the end of the episode without introducing me, but lovely to be here.
I'm just getting warmed up. And in fact... Yeah, this is what we need to do. So, the story so far, I hated the first 30 minutes, liked the second 30 minutes, and it's a bit of a thumbs down, I'm afraid, for the third 30 minutes as well. We're going to be looking at minutes 75 to 90 in this episode, and so it is quite a bit about Austerlitz. So, James, I better, I suppose, hand over to you, and let's... see whether your screenwriting expertise can help me and maybe some others in the Napoleonic community feel better about this sorry state of affairs.
Well, it's that's a tough ask, but I'll do my best, Alex. So, Austerlitz. We last time left off on quite a cliffhanger, didn't we? The Russian and Austrian armies are striding their way across the snow. Napoleon standing on a hill. We get another one of those lovely Star Wars-esque telescope shots. And then we see some of Napoleon's genius tactical nous that he's become so well known for. He says, wait until they think they have the higher ground.
It was puzzling, that, wasn't it?
Well, it confused me a bit, Alex, because I mean, I don't know this period very well, I'll admit that, but I can see that in battle... not having the higher ground would be a disadvantage. But thinking that you did have it and then not having it, I don't know what that does. I mean, either way, you don't have the higher ground.
It's mind games. That's what Napoleon's playing. It's all about perception and morale.
Mind games that the enemy are unaware of.
So the words he says, let them think they have the higher ground. And they are on what is... obviously a frozen lake, but...
Well, look, we're not there yet, Alex. Let's not leap ahead.
Okay, well, it's obviously a frozen lake between two pretty large mountains. Well, or no, hills, I suppose. Heights, you might even call them. And but no, they're obviously down in the valley, let's say. A valley that might be filled with a frozen body of water.
I mean, either way, Napoleon is stood amidst a quite enormous French army, all standing on a hill. So the idea that they think that they might have the higher ground is astonishing. Anyway, the battle starts in earnest, and it's really gruesome stuff. Lots of fighting and shouting and running. And it's obvious that the screenwriters have really got this idea of higher ground being imported into their heads, because Napoleon says it again. It's important that we keep the higher ground this time. High ground... very important in this period in military history, is my understanding.
Let me just ask a question. When screenwriters are writing about this sort of period, do they do research? Do they attend classes about the basics of military history? Because maybe maybe that's what happened here. And there was a firm understanding that the higher ground was important at Austerlitz.
I'd argue that it must have been quite a short lesson, because higher ground is the only thing that seems to have stuck. And it's notable here that another important tactical point, Napoleon says, cavalry from the west, pierce their flanks. Oh. It's all good battle-sounding stuff, isn't it?
It is, and actually, there is a way in which this depiction of Austerlitz is historically completely accurate. Now, that might be controversial to say, but it is, in terms of two lines said in the following order. In the actual Battle of Austerlitz, Napoleon saying, "Let them think they have the higher ground," is absolutely correct, because the Austrians and the Russians gathered on the top of the Pratzen Heights. Well, they did think they had the higher ground. They were allowed to think and indeed have the higher ground, because they were standing on the higher ground. And then we have the second line that comes in a bit later, when Napoleon says, "Send in the infantry, take their position on the higher ground." In the actual Battle of Austerlitz, that involves the infantry going up the higher ground to reach the higher ground, which is accurate. And when you're listening to it, as I have been obliged to do just now to sort of catch up, having watched it, of course, in 1 minute intervals, but anyway, when you listen to it, you hear the noise of the fighting, you hear those two lines. It could easily be completely accurate, but alas.
You're right. Look, I think probably from a screenwriting perspective, you're in a tough bind writing this kind of battle scene with your general as the protagonist, because what exactly does he have to do when all this fighting is going on? All you can have him do is striding up and down and saying sort of militaristic-esque things like "peace their flank."
Well, it's not just the generals who have the dialogue here, James. You've skipped over a phrase which is repeated by multiple cast members. It's two words. It's "stand to," it's said by Suchet, I think, initially, and then there are maybe about 10 repetitions in different voices and accents, and then at the 11th person, instead of saying "stand to," says "get ready." And then there's a few more stand twos. James, is that screenwriting? Was that "get ready" put in there just to clarify the situation to anybody who wasn't clear what "stand to" meant?
Well, yeah, precisely. I mean, I think it would probably be really helpful to the general audience. I was gobsmacked with confusion as everyone was saying "stand to." And then finally, I came to a moment of realisation at the end.
And that's because you don't know anything about the Napoleonic period.
I couldn't possibly make any guess from a contextual clue. But look, I think during this battle, I mean, it's pretty astounding on screen, I think. It's probably, it might have been better had you had a director on for this episode, Alex, because it's all very, you know, viscerally exciting. There's lots of horses, a little bit of CGI, giving it a slightly Game of Thrones feel. But nothing is really happening, narratively speaking. This battle is basically lots of people who we've never met before killing lots of other people who we've never met before. It seems to go on for quite a while. And with little, I suppose, narrative interest, although very visually stunning, that is until one of the Russians falls in the snow.
I was going to say, in terms of wants and needs for these characters, they all want to stay alive and they need to stay alive. So it's not too complex.
No, it doesn't have many levels. Doesn't have many levels to it. But I'll tell you someone who is a complex character, and that's this Russian soldier who is going to have a moment of true realization in the sort of a Grecian tragedy kind of sense, because he falls to the floor.
I'm trying to put off the moment when we reach that Russian soldier's realization, and so I'll ask you a question about Act Two, which you said before was about setbacks and progress being made, and so. Do we think that that there's evidence of that here, that maybe these Austrian soldiers had made progress and then now they're having a setback?
You know what's really interesting about this battle, Alex, is that it's entirely lacking in stakes for most of the people involved in it. And what I mean by that is, when we're in Toulon, if you remember that from the first half an hour, it seems like a long time ago now, we saw Napoleon having advances and setbacks. So He advanced on Toulon. His horse was bloodily murdered. He fought his way to the cannons before claiming them. This battle has none of that. Basically, this is just a one-sided trouncing of a poor Russian and Austrian army ill-equipped to defend itself. I don't know if that's true.
Well, it's a trap. That's what it is. And if the thing, and it was a trap in real life. It just wasn't this kind of trap. Okay, I'm now prepared to get to the Russian soldier.
So the Russian soldier falls to the ground, Alex. And for reasons we can't explain very easily, he looks down on the floor and starts sweeping away snow.
He probably, well, he fell over. He thought, oh, that feels a bit, that doesn't feel like frozen grass. Yeah. It just feels a bit like concrete. But wait, concrete hasn't been invented yet.
When I was walking on it, it felt like frozen grass. But now that I've fallen on it. So anyway, he brushes away the snow and he comes to a shocking realisation, Alex.
The ice ran chillingly through his veins. And
and chillingly under his feet. Yes, that's right. So the Russian soldier realizes that the entire Russian army has been fighting the entire time on a lake of ice, without fully realizing it, and now Napoleon is going to use that significantly to his advantage. He plays one of the classics. From a Napoleon perspective, he's going to go to his favourite instrument of war, the cannon.
The big guns.
But now they're his big guns, and they're pointing at the ice covered lake. Uncover the cannons, he says, though interestingly, you'll note, Alex, when they're fired, there's no sign of Napoleon covering his ears.
Ooh, is that character development?
Well, I don't know if you could say it's a sign of growth in Napoleon's character. You know, he's growing into his position as a leader and as a soldier. It's entirely possible that by this point they'd forgotten that they'd set up the fact that he covered his ears with cannons. It seems like a long time since we've had cannons, so maybe that's a possibility. But of course the cannons have the desired devastating effect, which is when they're fired they break the ice upon which the Russian soldiers are standing, and the Russians are plunged into what one has to assume is rather chilly water.
It took a while, actually, for me to begin to feel the pathos of the situation. I liked the scrabbling, the desperate scrabbling. That was good. But for a long time, it was just a lot of repetition, I suppose. How did you feel about the depiction of the battle in purely cinematic terms?
Well, like I said, I thought it was very well shot. It was, it was very badass. It was in slow motion. There was that little sequence where, you know, the Russian soldiers are trying to escape, and their standard bearer is in kind of this lonely march across the ice, and then eventually, his horse is kind of pulled down through the murky depths. It's all very kind of visually exciting. But does it move the story on much? What does it tell us? Have we been told any more about Napoleon or his position than we previously knew? I'm not sure.
No, apart from his ability to psychically deceive entire tens of thousands of men.
So look, I think it's possibly time for a history check, Alex, as is our wont. Is it the case that Austerlitz was won by Napoleon luring the Russian army onto a big lake of ice and then putting them through the ice?
James, the book I'm using in this mini-series, as you know, is The Story of Napoleon, a ladybird adventure from history book. It's intended for children in the United Kingdom in the late 1960s. It's obsessed with another battle, which seems to have taken place at sea, and that gets a good number of paragraphs about Trafalgar. And it doesn't really mention Austerlitz. It just says that Napoleon defeated the Austrians, the Prussians and the Russians in a series of battles which astounded the world. It doesn't say anything else about it. So, as unfortunately, I'm unwilling to consult any other historical reference works about Austerlitz, we're just going to have to let this one go.
So we're going to have to assume that it's reasonably accurate then. I mean, that's the only thing we can...
No, that's just a bit. The truth is, it's an outrage.
I mean, it's very interesting. Not to take us on a diversion, it's very interesting on the absence of Trafalgar to this story. Really, it's, I think it's possibly a very Americanized view. I can't imagine a fully.
Hang on, James. We've got a lot of American listeners.
We
can't afford to upset the American listeners.
Okay, I'm not getting into it, but I just can't imagine a British, a fully British production passing over Trafalgar in such a way.
Besides, the Americans would love Trafalgar. Everyone likes to see a good naval battle. The truth is that that choices had to be made. I would imagine a screenwriter would say, and the choice was to completely ignore essentially the. It's not just Trafalgar, but if the main adversary in this film was the English, then that might make a little bit more sense, because, and that would work quite neatly because of the outburst about the British boats, which was so unfortunate at the 1 hour mark. We had the English and their goats in Toulon at the beginning, so that was memorable. And given that we know that Waterloo is at the end, it would have made sense to include Trafalgar as another point to say, actually, the English are adversaries here. But instead, what we seem to get is a focus on maybe Josephine Napoleon, and then, of course, the defeated Austrian Emperor Francis I, unexpectedly played by the British comedian Miles Jupp with a Germanic accent.
He's back. Yes, the very next scene we have the return of the Jupp. Ostensibly, he's come as a supplicant, I guess, to Napoleon, and Napoleon's rather kind of charmingly naive with him, I think. He's like he's excited that it's the first time that he's met another emperor before, and he asks where the Tsar is, and of course the Tsar is not coming because he's sorely pissed off, maybe because of the ice lake trick that he feels like he's fallen for.
I think we could have at least have done with a shot of him shaking his fist.
Yes, I think this scene with Francis sort of reminds me a little bit of the you remember the Napoleon's tactics with the deputies in France when he. He put them under his soldiers' thrall and then said, let's vote. Again, he's suggesting peace here, but he's suggesting peace very much on his own terms.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, he's also trying to be very much of a social climber, isn't he? Trying to work his way up from being first consul to emperor status, but he doesn't seem like he's new money, or he's the new emperor of France as opposed to a Habsburg.
Yes, yeah, it's very much an Arriviste. I think you're right. I think you're right, Alex.
Arriviste.
And what better than a marker of peace than to have a mass fall? And Napoleon returns home to one, but also a situation that he finds significantly less easy to deal with than the Russian and Austrian armies. His mother.
Oh no, this is a tough scene.
Mama Napoleon has a plan for her son. She wants to do a little experiment vis-a-vis Napoleon and Josephine's fertility, and so she panders him out to an 18-year-old girl. In an attempt to discover whether Napoleon indeed can have a child.
And we've talked a lot before about mummy issues and the clear work done by the screenwriter to underline the importance of Napoleon's mother to him. She hasn't had much screen time, though, herself. So I'd really, really like your views on the whole that character and why we're getting this at this moment, if that makes sense. Was this her secret purpose all the way through? They knew this was what was going to happen, and so they had to work up to this by giving her some kind of ability to put him under her thrall and go and attempt to procreate with 18-year-old strangers.
Well, was it? I wouldn't say this is necessarily going to be the climax of her character. I don't know about that, but we're certainly learning a lot more about why Napoleon fears his mother to the extent that he does. She's a very forthright woman. She knows what she wants, and what she wants is the continuation of the kind of Napoleon dynasty. She's also very kind of very transactional. You know, it's all very much a You know, she's very straightforward in her request to Napoleon. He needs to shape up, get in there and impregnate that 18-year-old stranger.
And he's very much the heir of a 14-year-old being asked to unload the dishwasher.
Yeah, he's not happy about it. He takes a little bit of Dutch courage. And when he goes in to see the young woman, who, as you'd imagine, does not look too happy to be there, he blows out the candles to spare her blushes. Yeah, he's very much a man who's being, you know, having spoken about being a man of destiny, he's a man who's being subjugated at home, whereas obviously abroad he's a conquering hero.
Ah, so is he a prisoner of destiny by this stage? Because he does, that word destiny does crop up a little bit later on in his speechifying to Josephine.
Mm, yes, that's right.
Is that where we're heading to next?
I think it is. So, as often happens in this film, as soon as you suggest an impregnation, one occurs. The 18-year-old could not have got more pregnant more quickly. And that means bad news for Josephine. And I think she knows the writings on the wall, right? She asks him not to divorce her, but that looks like where it's heading.
Yeah, and I quite like Vanessa Kirby's acting in this 15 minutes. She does a few non-verbal actings, which I don't remember you ever asking me to do. Well, maybe you did.
I think you're very much a verbal actor, Alex. I don't want to stretch your capacities too far.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay, but she does it very well, and I think I like the way that they're sitting at their dinner table. There's a lot of distance between them, and he seems to be rolling out a pre-prepared set of remarks to break the news gently to her.
Yes. And look, he very much loves Josephine, that's really clear, and he doesn't want to take this step. I mean, the reason we know this is because a scene earlier, he's attempted to pass off his newly bastard son as Josephine's child by hatching a plot with a doctor who I know, of course, as the character who likes weak lemon drinks from Fist of Fun, Stuart Lee and Richard Herring's series from the late 90s.
And I know as the King William the First, the William the Conqueror in Horrible Histories from the late 2010s.
Yes, I think it's called like something Eldon.
Kevin Eldon.
Kevin Eldon, that's the one. Fantastic actor, but also a man of considerable character, because despite Napoleon's great position within France, the doctor just says no, and Napoleon folds like a house of cards. It's an incredibly brief attempt to avoid the necessity of divorce that falls to failure.
Maybe they could have done a bit more with this whole he's great, but he's also not so great at the same time thing, because they don't show him folding here, but it might have been quite interesting for him to have been frustrated or thwarted in some way or another that he can get, you know, they could have done something with that, maybe, that this idea that he can get his way in some areas, but not in others.
Yes. Or, as he says to Josephine, my destiny is more powerful than my will. You feel like he's just like being carried along now, whereas before he was embracing destiny as the thing that was going to drive him to become the great man of France. Now it's almost as though his destiny is making him a prisoner.
So just to on the three-act structure, is that part of it in terms of character development? I know we've talked about setbacks and successes in the second act, but is there any more that can be said here? I mean, I'm desperately trying to clutch at straws and find something here that makes this slightly better.
Yeah, look, from a screenwriting perspective, I think where you expect your central character to be is in the complete opposite direction as they were at the beginning of Act Two, right, vis-a-vis the central dramatic argument. And maybe the central dramatic argument here is you know, do you forge your destiny or does your destiny forge you? And at the beginning of Act Two, Napoleon is becoming, you know, kind of this great figure of France, and he's embodying his destiny. But now what we see is actually he's, you know, what he's, you know, presents as his destiny is something that is constraining him and is carrying him along in a direction that he's not interested in going.
That's very interesting. I'll have to think about that a bit.
Pretty good film, Alex. Pretty good film.
If you say so.
And then as we come up to the 1 hour 30 minute mark, they're in a very similar scene. I don't know if you noted this, Alex, as the scene in which Napoleon and Josephine got married, you know, with great good humour and cuddlings. They're stood in a very similar position, but this time they're giving, I suppose, the divorce vows. Seems a weird ceremony for them to be having.
I wasn't sure at all what was going on there, because there wasn't any words on the screen to say what was happening at the start of the scene.
Yeah, that is upsetting. It's very, very difficult to find your feet if we're not given that title card.
Hang on, James. What about, there was another scene as well where Josephine starts laughing as Napoleon finishes saying his line about a destiny or whatever to her, and she just laughs. And that reminded me, it seemed like a callback to perhaps their first meeting, or maybe second, when she was just laughing at him for being, you know, overdone and a bit pompous and puzzlingly... Hang on. Puzzlingly. What's the word? Hang on. Puzzlingly... not aloof, puzzlingly pompous and stiff.
Yeah, no, I think you're right, Alex. I mean, it's also an example of the laughing ending up on a serious note that I'm afraid our screenwriters have used a number of occasions already in this film. For example, when Mark Bonner, who we need to talk about his disappearance, what on earth has happened to Mark Bonner in the last half an hour of this film? But when he tells Napoleon that Josephine is having an affair, Napoleon does a very similar laugh, 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 then serious face.
Is it something, I mean, now you say it, it seems like it's something that all screenwriters everywhere do quite a lot of the time.
Sometimes you've got to have a crutch. But Napoleon, I think, has a rather good line here. You know, I think he says to Josephine, "You've embellished my life for 15 years." I think that's nice. I think that's got a nice ring to it, and also has a sort of an ambiguity to it as well, in that, you know, she's been such a big force in his life, but also embellishment seems to suggest a sort of decoration, something that can be taken on and then heaved off when necessary.
Yeah, that seems fair enough. Like, what are those Twitter banner are they called ribbons?
Yeah.
Like a Twitter ribbon that you can add on for a particular day of the year or whatever, and then that embellishes your X profile or whatever, and then away it goes.
I'm sure that's what the writer had in mind. And then at about 1 hour, 30 minutes exactly, Josephine is about to open her mouth to respond with her thoughts about the divorce, but I think that might be something we'll have to wait till the next episode to find out about.
So we've still got another four of these Napoleonic movie quarter hourly programmes to record. That's four times 15 minutes, so basically 1 hour left of the film.
And excitingly, if you remember, Alex, I watched this film in the cinema a few months ago. But this around this point was where I fell asleep for a brief period of time during the film. And so I'm really about to step over a threshold into the unknown.
Oh, no. OK, well, that really makes things interesting, because the question mark is, we're looking for surely the start of Act Three. Roughly when does Act Three start in a standard Hollywood film?
So the last half an hour... In a two hour Hollywood film would be about right.
So two and a half here. So maybe give it another 15 minutes of Act Two, and then something happens.
We should definitely be keeping our eye out for a big threshold that Napoleon's got to cross.
Oh, that's exciting. I thought the start of Act 3 was when everything changes. Poof.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is it? Yeah, okay, yeah. I wonder what that could be. Maybe Napoleon starts losing instead of winning. That would be good.
I think it's, you know, I think it's the moment where the character comes into their final form, when they reach their fullness. So Napoleon is going to become his most Napoleon on the edge of Act 3.
Peak Napoleon.
Mm. But before the end of Act 3, of course, we've got the long, dark night of the soul to engage with. Maybe we could talk about that next episode.
Okay, well, in that case, let's leave it there for now. James, I've got somebody waiting in the next room for you. It's hardly a distasteful task.
Well, look, Alex, you've embellished my podcast for the last 30 minutes.
Bye for now.